Okay, Kenny, so we'll talk about the horse. The great-grandfather somehow sees the horse eating these unusual plants, and he starts to mix this stuff up himself.
You bet. And, you know, as I mentioned, there's a whole school of pharmacy now, based of science, based around exactly this fact. Jane Goodall has proven it with chimpanzees in Africa who self-medicate. So the animals have very strong instincts. And I live in the Southwest, and I have a lot of Native American friends. And when I told them this story, they kind of looked at me and they said, well, what do you think we did? Went out and tasted every plant and hoped it didn't kill us? We watched the animals. You know, so it's a very ancient tradition.
How did the horse know what to eat?
Because instinctively it knew. That's what we need to be studying, right?
You know,
as you said earlier, George, there's an incredible healing power in nature if we just know where to look and pay attention.
I think so, too. Okay, so he mixes this up. Then what's he do with it?
Well, he became very famous as a veterinarian. He worked for Ringling Brothers Circus, treating animals with cancer and tumors, and became quite famous. And he passed these formulas down through the generations, and Harry Hoxie's father was the first one to try it on people, and he repeatedly got positive results. And when Harry was quite young, he was 15 years old, his father had an untimely accident and was on his deathbed. And Harry had, as a child, developed a real sort of passion for healing. He just had a feeling for it.
Yeah.
He worked with his dad for years. And so on his dad's deathbed, he bequeathed the formulas to him, which he had kept secret. And in the course of this transmission, he told young Harry that as a Quaker, he always had to treat poor people for free, you know, rich or poor, whether or not you could pay. And he warned him, he prophesied to watch out for the high priests of medicine who would fight him tooth and nail if he tried to bring this into the world. And he told the boy, go to medical school and try to become a doctor. And so he gave him these formulas and made him memorize them and then burn up the actual paper with the formulas on them, you know. And that's when Harry, he at that time was working in the coal mines. And he was kind of an interesting, kind of a Baron von Munchausen character. He played semi-pro ball for three different baseball teams under different names, and he sold insurance and tried to put himself through college. And then one dark, stormy night, there was a knock on his door, and this guy showed up that he remembered from his childhood, who was an old Civil War veteran who was dying of cancer. And he begged Harry to treat him. And Harry said, you know, I can't. I'm going to go to medical school. I'll get in trouble, and I'll get blackballed. And the guy said, well, you know, if you don't heal me, you're going to kill me. I mean, are you a murderer? So Harry swore him to secrecy and treated him, and the guy got well.
Oh, my.
And before he knew it, he had more people showing up on his door. Word spread. And in 1924, he opened the first Hoxie Cancer Clinic in southern Illinois. And that's when things got really interesting.
Now, whereabouts in southern Illinois? Because, you know, I'm in L.A. now, but I'm also in St. Louis at any given time. That must be pretty close.
Yeah, I was in Taylorville, not far away.
Know it well. Know it very well. As a matter of fact, I had a horse farm near Taylorville.
Wow.
I would be amazed. Well, it can't be. I would be amazed if the great-grandfather's horse farm was the one I ended up buying a long time ago from
Wow.
Winnipeg.
You never know.
Boy, that would be too strange.
Destiny, huh?
Now I have to check into it.
So what happened was his fame spread very, very quickly. You know, at first he was backed by the Chamber of Commerce of Taylorville, who thought they'd become the cancer capital of the world. I mean, who would oppose a cure for cancer, right? And so Chicago, of course, was close by, which was the headquarters of the newly powerful American Medical Association.
Mm-hmm. And very powerful indeed.
Very powerful. And headed by Dr. Morris Fishbein, who was the head of the AMA Journal, which became the tail that wagged the dog because it was such a profitable publication, because they were the gatekeepers to advertising and to all medical products, right? Which had to be approved by the medical
profession. Oh, absolutely. First of all, they didn't have television then. And in that era, once radio started, I don't think they were allowing pharmaceutical ads, were they?
Well, sure. In the 1920s, that was what they built their whole thing on, was basically advertising.
Yeah, just for the magazine, but I mean not on radio or anything like that.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, no, exactly right. Yeah.
All right, so in your book, which you call When Healing Becomes a Crime, what happened? Something happened.
Well, something happened, indeed, and here's where we know some and we don't know some, but the stories diverge. But what we do know, and I spent, as I say, years and years researching this, and I got into the archives of the AMA itself, and they saved every scrap of paper. They have incredible files. So I was able to document a huge amount of this. But basically, he was invited to Chicago to a very, reputable hospital to demonstrate his treatment on a terminal patient. And I found photographs, before and after pictures and all the medical records, a police sergeant who had a huge lethal tumor on his shoulder. And Hoxie treated the man successfully. And shortly after, he held a demonstration where he actually removed this dead tumor from this patient who lived on for another 20 years and testified on Hoxie's behalf in trials. He was invited into a back room of the AMA where he was offered a contract for the rights to his formulas. And this we do not know. I mean, this is what Hoxie says. The AMA denies it, of course. But whatever happened, that's when the battle started. And Hoxie basically asked that poor people be treated for free, and he wanted the Hoxie name on it, which his father had asked him to do. And, of course, that didn't fly. And some kind of, fight occurred, and Hoxie refused to sell them the formula. And that's when the battle started. And for the next 35 years, organized medicine went after him tooth and nail. And Hoxie won all the battles, only to finally lose the war 35 years later.
What did they do to him ultimately, Kenny?
Well, ultimately, they could never get him, except on finally a technicality, which was that because he was a layperson, he became a naturopath, but he didn't have a medical degree. They claimed that he could not own a clinic that treated patients, and that was how they finally shut him down. But he won the most astonishing sequence of court trials, including two federal courts that upheld the therapeutic value of the treatment.
And not until he moved to Tijuana, right?
Yeah, finally in 19... Well, they shut him down in this country in 1960, but during that time, he had clinics in 17 states, but his main clinic, the headquarters, was in Dallas, Texas, and they had 12,000 patients in the middle of the 1950s. And just to give you a sense of scale, today the two biggest cancer treatment centers in the country, Sloan Kettering and MD Anderson, each have about 13,000 patients. So it was huge, huge, and very, very famous.
Is it still operating?
Well, yeah, his chief nurse, Mildred Nelson, whom I got to know very, very well, I made a film before I wrote the book, she took it to Tijuana in 1963, and they were actually the granddaddy of all the alternative clinics. They were the first one to go south of the border.
I've seen this on HBO.
Yeah, the film actually played in movie theaters in about a dozen cities, and then it made HBO in 1988, and it got the highest viewer response of any documentary that ever shown at that time.